Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the Omaha Public Library on Noon Forum. As part of the library's 2017 Stories of Survival, Eyewitness Holocaust Testimonies series, we'll hear a talk by B. Karp, a Nebraska resident, a survivor of Nazi-occupied Germany, and author of My Broken Doll. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 12, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Public Library, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to tell her story of survival in Nazi-occupied Germany during World War II is our guest speaker, B. Karp.
I was born in Germany, Lauterbach, Germany. And I was born just a few months before Hitler came to power. And so I never knew what it was like to live without a Hitler. But at first, I must say that I had a normal childhood. You know, I was able to go outside, play with friends, and I didn't worry about what was going on in the world. And my family consisted of my parents, a sister who is younger than I am, and at that time, my grandma lived with us, who I adored. I loved her very much. And also an uncle and aunt who were married, and another uncle who was still a young man, and he still was going to college. And one day, he came home, and suddenly I heard loud voices. And it was him, my uncle, having arguments with my father. And these arguments were about whether we should leave Germany or not. I heard my uncle say, "Things are not going well for the Jews. It's time that we leave. Let's go before it gets any worse." But my father, he had always lived in Germany. As a matter of fact, my family had lived there since the 1600s. And he felt that surely somebody is going to stop this madman Hitler. But as you know, nobody did. In 1936, my uncle had had enough, and he decided he would leave. He took my grandma with him, and also my aunt and uncle. I was very upset. And they left for what was then known as Palestine, but today it is Israel. We stayed on for a little while longer. I don't know how much time. You know, at that age that I was, time didn't mean anything to me, and I can't tell you, give you the times exactly. But one day, things changed for us. Because one day, my parents came home. It was in the afternoon, and they were very, very upset. What had happened was, they had to go and register at a Nazi office. And that meant that all the Jews in Germany had to go and register at that Nazi office. So the Nazis knew where every Jew lived. Not only that, they received identity cards. And on those cards, there was a big J, which stood for Jude. And Jude means Jew. Also, every man and woman received a middle name. The men were all called Moses. The women were called Sarah. These identity cards had to be worn when you went out into the street. You didn't dare be without them. Then, the next thing that happened to us, our home was taken away from us because Hitler declared Jews could not hold any property. We couldn't own anything anymore. So we had to give up our house. What's more, we couldn't take furniture or anything out of it, except just a couple of suitcases, I think my parents took. That was it. And my father decided that we should go to a bigger city by the name of Karlsruhe. The reason we went there was he had a brother living there with his family. And when we arrived in Karlsruhe, we couldn't find an apartment because Hitler decreed that Jews and non-Jews were not allowed to do business with each other. We couldn't, as a matter of fact, have anything to do with each other anymore. It was like a wall was put up. So we couldn't find an apartment, and we stayed with my aunt and uncle, their three children. Now, they had a small apartment, I remember. My sister and I, we shared the bedroom with our three cousins, and it was bedlam. But we made do. I don't remember again how much time passed by. I think it was maybe about 6 weeks or so when my father was lucky enough to find an apartment for us. The apartment was above a bank. It was a very small apartment. It consisted only of three rooms. The main entryway was through the kitchen door. On one side of the kitchen was the bedroom, on the other side the living room. The bathroom was out in the hallway, and we shared it with another family. But we didn't care. At least we had a place of our own. What bothered me and what I missed a lot was I didn't have a yard to play in anymore. But my parents decided that it was okay for me to go downstairs and play in front of our apartment. But I always had to stay in front of it. I couldn't go anywhere else. So I listened. I thought that was better than nothing at all. And I also made some friends, and I had a good time. One day when we were playing down there, I noticed two Nazis approaching us. Now, I had always heard about the Nazis, but I had never seen any up close. And as they came closer, I looked at them. And as I looked at them, I thought to myself, these are the people causing all our problems. And an emotion came over me that I had never experienced before, and that emotion was hatred. I hated them. And as day went by, without even thinking, I go to the gutter, I pick up some pebbles, and as day passed by, I threw those pebbles at their backs, not really meaning to hit them. But I was angry. I was mad at them. Well, some of the pebbles did hit them because they turned around and started going after us. It was just lucky that we knew the alleyways of Karlsruhe better than they did, and we managed to escape. But when I came back to our apartment, my mother was absolutely furious with me. She had watched the whole incident from our living room window. And the first thing she said to me in German, "Du bist ein Dummkopf." Oh, some of you know what that means. That means you are stupid. And she said, "From now on, I cannot let you play by yourself outside anymore. Either your father or I will have to be with you. So my life changed again. It became more restrictive. But for the Jewish people, life also had become very restrictive because signs appeared in windows of stores, and these signs read Juden verboten, which means Jews are forbidden here. And these signs appeared not only in stores, in the windows, but also in front of movie houses, your symphonies, theaters, everywhere. Even in the park we used to frequent on a Sabbath afternoon when the weather was nice. We couldn't go into the park anymore. So we were pretty much homebound, all of us. We couldn't go anywhere anymore. Yeah, things got worse and worse. It was time for me to also go to school. And school there was quite different than what you have here. The teachers, very, very strict, only man teachers. And it was perfectly all right for them if you didn't follow orders. Like, for instance, if you sat at your desk and you had your elbows on the table, that was a no-no. You had to have your feet planted on the floor at all times. You couldn't cross your legs. You never spoke to your two other kids. You never dared look out of the window. It was strictly learning. And in one, looking back on it, thank God I did have a little bit of schooling. And if you disobeyed orders, it was perfectly all right for the teacher to hit the boys wherever the hand landed. And for us girls, we had to go to the front of the room where there was a desk, and the teacher would take his ruler, and we had to hold our hands like so. We'd take the ruler and hit the tips of our fingers. And that hurt. So I tried to be a good girl. And all of this I took in stride. I didn't know any different. But the thing that I remember the most and that hurt the most was it was at that time that I learned how horrible hatred and prejudice is. Going to school and going back home was a nightmare because some of the kids would go after us yelling, "Dirty Jew, Christ killer." And I always used to say to them, "I took a bath this morning," or "I washed this morning, and I didn't kill anybody. I don't know what you're talking about." And when I would tell my mother, she would say, "Don't worry about it. They're the others." But she never explained. Well, school lasted for about a year. But also I have to tell you that I taught my kids never, never to have prejudice against anyone. To accept people for who and what they are. And be friends with everybody. As long as they're good people, that's what it is important. And thank God, they also taught that to my grandchildren. It would be a much better world if we didn't have prejudice and hatreds. We might not even have any wars. It's very, very important. So school lasted for a year, then Hitler said, "No more school for Jewish children." My father tried to teach us a little bit, but that didn't last very long because then came the night of the broken class, November 9 and 10. Yes, that night we were woken up. there was so much noise out on the street. I remember us going to the window, and as I looked out, there were fires all over. It was as though the whole town of Karlsruhe was burning, fires all over. What had happened? The Nazis were burning all the synagogues. A synagogue is equivalent to a church. They were burning them all over Germany. Not only that, they went into Jewish-owned homes. They broke the windows. They broke the store windows. And they took whatever they wanted to take. And sometimes they even threw furniture out in the streets. It was a horrible, horrible night. I have often thought, even at that time I was thinking, how come nobody is doing anything about this? This is terrible. And I wondered, how come the German people didn't stand up to Hitler and say to him, enough is enough? But no one did. No country came to our aid. Nobody said anything. And therefore, Hitler had the green light to go on with what he was doing, to murder all the Jews. When my father saw that our synagogue was burning, he got dressed, said goodbye to us, and decided he would try and save as many Jewish articles that he could from the synagogue. And we thought we'd see him in an hour or so. Well, we waited for him to come home that night. I still can see my mother pacing the bedroom floor back and forth, wondering where is he, why isn't he coming home? He never did come home. The next day, we found out that all the men that had gone into the street were rounded up, and they were taken to concentration camps. Not only that, there was so much glass laying on the streets that that night is called the Night of the Broken Glass, or Kristallnacht. It was a horrible, horrible night. I don't remember how much time passed, but one day I was playing in the kitchen when suddenly our door opened up, our front door, and there stood this man all covered with mud and blood, and he was shaking and he was bent over. We had right across from that door a black wood-burning stove, and as he came through the door, he went straight to that stove. And he was about to put his hands on it. And it was at that very moment that I recognized my father. And I screamed, Papa, Papa, it's hot. Well, my cries made my mother come into the kitchen. She took one look at him. And she went towards him. And quickly took him into the bedroom. He was a sick man for quite some time, but my mother couldn't call any doctors. She had to nurse him herself, and she did, I guess, a good job, because after a while, my dad would be gone all day long, and he'd come home sometimes in the evenings quite late, and he would complain that his fingers and hands and arms were hurting him. So one day I said to him, Papa, what do you do? And he says, I've become a bricklayer. And when he told me that, I thought to myself, my father's not a bricklayer, he's a businessman. And then I found out that he had been put to forced labor. Yeah, life was tough, but it got tougher. One day, there was a loud knock on the kitchen door. My mother opens up the door, and there stood two Gestapo, two Nazis. I could tell she was very, very scared. But she said to them, "What do you want?" And they said, "Just go and pack." And she says, "Well, for how long are we going to be gone, and where are you taking us?" And they got angry with her and yelled at her, "Marschnell, Marschnell, Howie, Howie, don't ask so many questions, just go pack." So my mother went to pack. She went to the bedroom. And I thought to myself, well, since we're leaving, I better take my baby doll. I had a doll that I always had. I don't know even who gave her to me, but I loved that doll very, very much, and I always used to take her wherever I went. So I go to the living room to pick her up, but one of the Nazis follows me. He sees me picking up the doll. He takes a hold of my arm, and he says to me, "Where you're going, you don't need this doll." And I looked at him, and I thought to myself, huh, he wants that doll. But out loud, he says, "That you don't need that doll where you're going, where we're going." And I thought to myself, I'm not going to give that doll to him. I said, "You can't have her." And I took my doll that I loved so very much, and I threw her on the floor, and her face, which was made out of porcelain, broke into many, many pieces. I was very upset. I was so upset that I don't remember my father or my sister being with us during that whole time. I only remember my mother. After a long while, I decided to join my mother in the kitchen, and as I go towards the kitchen, I look around that small apartment and I think to myself, I just know I'll never see this place again. I was very upset. I got to the kitchen, I took a hold of the leg of the kitchen table, and I wouldn't let go of it. My mother had the worst time trying to pry my hand loose and getting me out of the door. The Nazis took us to the railroad station. And there the whole station was filled with people. What had happened was the Nazis had rounded up all the Jews of Karlsruhe, and they were deporting us. This was October 1940. We didn't have the communication that we have now. We didn't know really what was going on. The little of communication that we did have was Nazi controlled. So we really didn't know what was going on. And I still remember people saying, "What's going to happen to us? What are they going to do with all of us?" We didn't know what the future held for us. After a long wait, the train came. And it was a regular train. And we were put onto the train. And it was very, very crowded, that train, because there were so many of us. And as we were traveling into the countryside, some people decided to open up the window so we would get some cool, fresh air. And because of that, some people thought to escape. And they would jump out of the windows and try to get away, not realizing that there were Nazis on the roof of the train. They had guns. And as these people tried to get away, they were shot at. How many made it? I don't know. I just heard the shots. But the train kept going the whole time. And after a while, it stopped on the border of Germany and France. Soon we heard a voice over the loudspeaker saying many things. I only remember two things. One of them was, if you have any money on you, get rid of it. If you disobey orders, you will be shot. I noticed my mother hiding money on her person, and I became panicky. And I did something that usually young children never did to their elders, and that was to elevate your voice at them. You just never did that. It was considered very impolite. But I said to her, "Mother, didn't you hear what they said? They're going to kill you." And she says, "Well, everybody hurt you. Here, take the money. Go put it down the toilet." There were just a few bills. Most of the money was left behind. It was left under our mattress in the apartment in Karlsruhe, because a Jew wouldn't dare put money in the bank. It would be taken from you. So it was just a few bills. So I go to the toilet, throw the bills in, and as I walk back, I look into all the other compartments. Sure enough, I noticed the Nazis were searching everyone. If somebody disobeyed orders, they were taken off the train. When they were all done, they lined up all these people on the platform and shot every one of them. Once again, I heard the shots, but my mother didn't want me to see. She took my face, put it in her lap. And then the train started up again, and now we were in for a long journey, because they were taking us to the southern part of France, Vichy France. Vichy France, they collaborated with the Nazis. And that's where the camps were. It was a long journey, probably a day and a half to 2 days. I don't actually know. I don't remember much of it. I must have slept most of the time. Except I was hungry and thirsty. They didn't give us anything to drink, nothing to eat. So I would go around sometimes and lick the windows of the train just to get some moisture within me. When we arrived at our destination, they took us off the train, put us onto trucks, and these trucks took us to the concentration camp. The name of the camp is Gurs, G-U-R-S. It was a very large camp. The first time I caught sight of it, it gave me a most dismal feeling, because it looked all gray, brown, and black, barbed wire all around it, one barrack after the other, hardly any grass, hardly any trees, nothing much. And when we got off the train, we sank into the mud. It rained a lot there, and it was very, very muddy, and it was hard to walk. And also when we got off the train, off the truck, then they separate the men and the women, and I was very unhappy. I didn't want to say goodbye to my father. I want him to stay with us. I made a big fuss, but then my mother consoled me, and she says, "The men's camp is next door. We're only separated by barbed wire, and your father, you'll be able to see your father once in a while." So I calmed down and said goodbye to him, but it was very difficult. I didn't want him to leave. Then they put the women in the law in a large barrack, and there searched again. If you had any gold in your teeth, like the gold fillings or gold crowns, they pulled your teeth. If you had any gold jewelry, they took that. My mother happened to have pierced ears, and she had gold hoop earrings, and she tried to take them off, but it wasn't quick enough for the Nazi standing by us, and he came over and just pulled her earrings right off her earlobes. To this day, I still can hear her cry out with the pain. Then they assigned barracks to us and gave us mattresses. I was able to carry that mattress. It was a single mattress. The reason it was so light was it was just filled with straw. Then we went to our barrack, and it was completely dark. We couldn't see what was inside because there were no windows, but somebody found some flaps to be held open, and there we saw what was in the barrack. It was just one bed after the other. There was a pot-bellied stove, and there were no chairs, no tables, but there was a scale hanging in the middle of it. And I wondered about the scale, but not for too long. Once a day, they would throw one loaf of bread into the barrack to be divided amongst us all. So one lady was chosen to do the dividing. And it was not easy for her to do so. I never saw any eating utensils while I was at the camp. She had to break off a piece of bread, weigh it, and hand it out. And at first it worked. But we became very hungry. We didn't get much food. And when you're hungry, it hurts. When you're starving, it hurts, I should say. And fights would break out between these women. These women, who had been ladies once upon a time, became animals. It was an ugly sigh, an ugly sigh. My sister and I, we treaded it each day. The other thing that they would give us to drink, it was more to drink than to eat, was soup at lunchtime and dinner time. And that was it. That's what we existed on. It was a work camp. Oh, I should first tell you about the sanitary conditions. They were non-existent. I never saw any running water. My mother had somehow gotten a hold of a tin can, and she would put it outside. And when it rained, when the can was full of water, she would bring it in, and that's the way she would wash us off. I never took a bath, no shower. I don't think I even brushed my teeth. I don't remember. But so it was. This camp was also a work camp. So we didn't see our mother during the day. They were put to work. And us children, we had to be sharply every day at 9 o'clock in front of a certain barrack, and there they would have roll call for us. And we had to be there sharply at 9, and then they would take us on long, long walks. As a matter of fact, we got holes in the bottom of our shoes, and I still remember my mother trying to find, like, anything to put in the shoes so we wouldn't get any calluses. Yeah, life was tough. Also, since our parents were not there, they had somewhat a program for us. And in the afternoons, we would go to that large barrack, and there I learned a lot of games, and I used to have a good time with kids my age, and I enjoyed myself. And a woman would come, and she would sing and yodel for us. And because she yodeled, I thought, well, she must be from Switzerland. So one day I went up to her. I said to her, you know, you see the way we live. Can't you do something about it? And she stroked my hair and says, things are going to get better. Don't you worry. Things are going to get better. So I took her for her word that things would get better. I waited every day, but nothing ever got better. And I was wondering how my father was, because looking at my mother sometimes, I would see her getting undressed at night, and her bones were sticking out. She looked so thin, and so I was wondering how our father was doing. So one day I said to my sister, let's go visit him. And she says, you're crazy. They're not going to let you. And I said, well, let's try. So one day I took her hand, and we went to the entrance of the camp. Right away the guard comes out asking, what are you doing here? And in a very polite way, I said to him that we want to visit our father and we would not run away. We'd come right back. But he argued with me. What he said, I don't remember. But I got very angry at him. I kicked him on his boot and I said to him, tu sale cochon, which is French for you dirty pig. And we marched out of the camp, and I said to my sister, whatever you do, don't look back. He might shoot us. Well, he didn't shoot us. And somebody in the men's camp told us where our father was. And so we went there, and my father could hardly believe it when he saw us coming. We were so overjoyed of being together. You have no idea. We cried for happiness. And we had a good visit, but something happened during that visit. The Nazis were handing out to everyone eggs, raw eggs in the shell. Okay. So when my father got his egg, he opened it up very carefully. And then he took his finger and he mixed the yellow and the white so it would be more edible. But he got real agitated. I wondered why. So I go look into the egg. And lo and behold, there was blood in it. And I knew what that meant, because we were an Orthodox family, Jewish Orthodox family, and follow certain dietary laws. And because of that, we couldn't eat that egg. But I thought to myself, oh, he'll make an exception. After all, we're starving. But my father took that egg, threw it against the wall of the barrack, and to this day I can see this yellow ooze come down. And I go make a run to lick it off. As I got to the wall and I happened to turn around and I saw the expression on my father's face, I couldn't do it. But I was angry with him. I didn't understand him at that time to have done such a thing. After all, we were starving. And it took me a while to get it, what he was saying. By his actions. What he was saying to us was this: I have no control as to what the Nazis do with me physically, but mentally, I still have a choice. I can do what is right, or I can do what is wrong. And it was a lesson that I have never, never forgotten. We got back to the women's camp, and it must have been uneventful because I don't remember a thing about it. Soon after that, my mother sent my sister out of the camp because she had gotten so weak she could hardly walk anymore. My mother and I, we stayed at that concentration camp for a while longer, when suddenly we were transferred to another concentration camp by the name of Wivzald. And there it was more or less the same thing, except I must have been even hungrier because I would go to the garbage cans, and I was in competition with the mice and the rats, and I came down with cholera. They put me into a small infirmary. It was a small room. It had one window and the bed I was sleeping in, and that was it. One day, I noticed my father standing outside of the window, and I could hardly believe it that he had come to see me. I was so overjoyed. And I asked him, "How come they let you come and see me?" And he says, "It's because I'm being transferred to Limmel." I didn't know what that meant, and it was a good thing because we had a good visit. Thank God for that. Because that was the last time that I saw my dad. But I didn't know it at that time. Because Limmel was on the road to Auschwitz. I got better, and my mother came for me, and on the way to our barrack, she said, "You know, you cannot last much longer here. It's time for you to also leave." But I didn't want to leave her. I wanted to stay with her. She was the only security that I had left. But nevertheless, one day she took me to a place where there was a truck, and we were 15 or so kids put onto that truck. I cried bitterly, saying goodbye to her. I didn't want to leave her. It was the hardest thing that I had done up to that point in my life, having to say goodbye to my mother. We were driven out of that camp. There is this organization which is still in existence today. It's a French-Jewish organization. In French, it's called Œuvre de secours aux enfants, which means Homes for the Rescue of Children. And for short, we call them the OSE, and I'm still in touch with them to this day. We were driven to our first home, Château de Couret. And there we were about 100, 150 kids. And naturally, the food was better, and they were very nice to us. They tried to make things as comfortable as possible. They also taught us how to speak French. They gave us new identity cards saying that we were French, born in Paris, France. Also, they changed our names to French-sounding names. I was born Beate, which is very German, and they changed it to Beatrice. I was very happy about it. I didn't want to be German anymore. I liked the idea of being French. So I took all of that in stride. But the Nazis were still after us. They knew where we were. When our name came to the top of the list, they were after us. And so this organization would take the kids that were in danger and take them to another home. And this happened quite often. I was moved 14 different times. And one day I arrived at this at Chateau de Chaumont, it was, and a little girl comes and brings me a blanket. I looked at her and she looked at me, and it took us just a few seconds to recognize each other. It was my sister. We were so happy to be together again. I vowed that I would never, never leave her again, that we will always stay together. And we did. We stayed in those homes until 1943. By then, Hitler had the death camps established, and he was in a bigger hurry than ever to murder all the Jews. This organization wasn't safe anymore either. So they had to do something with us children. Some of the children went to Christian families. Others went to, they went on farms. And some of us went into a Catholic boarding school convent. That's where my sister and I ended up. It was in Millau, the northern part of France. It was a small town. And it was a very nice convent. The sisters were very nice to us. And we did everything that the Catholic children did. We studied the catechism. So I found out who Jesus is, finally. And I even said to one of the sisters, I didn't want to kill Jesus. I didn't know what it was all about, you know? And she says, I know you didn't. and then we went to church, and I liked it very much, and we had chocolate pudding on Sundays. So I liked that too. one of the sisters I made friends with, her name was Sœur Espérance, which means Sister of Hope. And she became my good friend. She was a young sister, and she played games with us. I think that's why I liked her so much. I do like to play games. And I told her a little bit about my background and everything. But one day I went up to her and I said to her, you know, Sœur Espérance, I would like to stay with you. I don't want to move again. I'm tired of moving. May I stay in the convent? And she looked at me and she said, I tell you what, if you still feel that way after the war, you can come back to us. But in the meantime, I want you to remember your father's teachings. And it was at that time that I did remember my father's teachings. And I realized a few things. I realized if I would be giving up my Judaism, not only would I be giving up my parents, I would also be giving up my heritage, my sister, everything that I'd ever known. So I couldn't do it. And the other thing that I realized was, religion is the one thing that nobody can take away from you. And we stayed at the convent until almost the end of the war. And then this Jewish French organization took us back again. And now what to do with all of us? In my case, and also my sister's, they advertised in a German Jewish newspaper called the Aufbau that Beate and Susie Stern were looking for any living relatives. And it was my grandma in Israel who saw the advertisement. She naturally was overjoyed to know that we were still alive. And she contacted the rest of the family that was still alive. I had an aunt and uncle in England and two aunts in New York City. They all wrote to us. They all wanted us. I want to go to Israel in the worst way, but they said it would be too much of a trip for you. You couldn't, it would be too much for you. You can't do it. So they decided we should go to England. In June or July 1945, we left for England. We were one of the lucky ones, my sister and I. Yes, because 1.5 million children were murdered. We were very lucky. I still remember when we crossed the English Channel, I also met my first Americans. They were waves. and they took very good care of us. We all threw up. It was pretty rough going over the English Channel. But we got there okay to England, and then we took a train to London. And my aunt and uncle were waiting at the station for us, and it was wonderful being with family, to live in a house again. And the thing that I remember also is, after being there about 2 days or so, I found myself walking on the sidewalk all by myself. And it was nice weather, I remember. And suddenly, I was skipping and singing. I felt very happy and very light, as though a big weight had been lifted off my shoulders. And at the age of 12, I realized something. For the first time in my life, I was free. I did not have to worry anymore. I was not in danger anymore. Free, to be free. And that is what democracy means to me. Not to be afraid. I always tell the school children, be sure that you vote. Not only just vote, you also have to know who you vote for. It is so important. Yes, because they are the future of our United States. I tell this story in memory of my parents and the 6 million Jews that were murdered. Also, there were 5 million other people that were also murdered because they did not go along with Hitler's philosophy. It was a dark period in our history, and I hope to God that it will never, never be repeated, that we may always live in peace. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'll be very happy to answer them. Thank you.
How did you get to the United States?
How did I get to the United States? Well, we were lucky. Sears and Roebuck are very, very, very distant relatives of ours. And so they knew about us. But also, They sponsored other kids, and they're the ones that had us come to the United States because we came in style. We came by plane. We were very fortunate. Yes.
How old were you?
By the time I came to the United States, I was 15.
How long did it take you before you could talk about this?
It took me a while. I tell you, we used to live in O'Neill, Nebraska. We were the only Jewish family there. And they took an interest remember the Eichmann trial, which was in 1963? And after that, they had me come to a teacher's tea once. They wanted me to tell the story. And my husband encouraged me, even though I didn't really want to do it. But he said, it's important, you got to do it. And he encouraged me and helped me a lot through it all. And so I told my story, and after I spoke to the teachers, they asked me to come to their schools. And that's the way the whole thing happened. So I've been on and off. I have been speaking since 1963, yes.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you went to the camps?
I was 8 years old when they came for us.
You know, you learned a lot about the history talking to other people who been through the Holocaust and that. For example, those when they registered the Jews, what happened to the people who were Jewish who refused to register? And why did they and how did they go so willing to register that they are Jewish? What was there a law? Was there a how did that go about?
I don't know. I was too young. I don't know, but I know they had to go and register. Yeah, exactly.
Let's give B. Karp one more round of applause for such a great talk.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Omaha Public Library on Noon Forum. As part of the library's 2017 Stories of Survival Eyewitness Holocaust Testimonies series, we've heard a talk by B. Karp, a Nebraska resident, a survivor of Nazi-occupied Germany, and author of My Broken Doll. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 12, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Emily Getchman, Marketing Director for the Omaha Public Library, and Anna Wilcoxon, Adult Services Librarian, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 700 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.